Dark Winter Nights is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Journalism Department. UAF Journalism. Tell great stories.
Welcome back to the second season of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. In this episode, I use children to play a prank on the people of the UAF campus, and it turns out to be a really bad idea.
And you said, try to cry, and so I pretended to cry, and then you said, okay, maybe not cry, because you might get arrested.
Yes, that was maybe not the best idea.
Another child falls prey to that flat part at the end of the escalator.
For a minute, it was fun, but then, ouch!
A man recalls being kidnapped and taken to Alaska.
Him and his girlfriend picked me and my brother up at the house and kidnapped us and decided we're going to go to Alaska.
And a 7-year-old girl refuses to eat ice cream.
And the lady behind the counter with her best intentions says, oh, honey, she said, would you like an ice cream cone? I said, no, I do not want an ice cream cone.
When I was younger than I am now. Stories from childhood told by some folks who are still children. Coming up next on Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. This summer, Dark Winter Nights storyteller liaison Colleen Wood and I put on a kids' storytelling camp here in Fairbanks for kids 2nd through 7th grade. Now, what good storytelling camp wouldn't be able to generate a story of its own? Certainly not ours. Our story starts at the shuttle bus stop on UAF's campus. If you're a parent, or have ever had to spend a significant amount of time with children, I mean, had the pleasure of spending a significant amount of time with children, you know that if you can come up with just the right game or just the right way to spin an idea, you can get incredibly good behavior out of kids when they might otherwise have gotten a little sideways. Well, that's the situation I found myself in on the 4th straight day of kids' storytelling camp this summer. For 6 hours a day, I was trying to teach kids in 2nd through 7th grade how to tell better stories, and frankly, by day 4, it was starting to get a little old for everybody. This particular morning, 6th, 2nd, and 3rd graders and I had been standing at the UAF bus stop for 30 minutes waiting for the campus shuttle that comes every 10 minutes. The kids were getting antsy, and I knew I needed something to keep their minds occupied. It was at that moment that I was hit with potentially the greatest parenting idea of my life. It was an idea so ingenious, so unbelievably cunning, that I still marvel that I was able to come up with it at 9:30 a.m. on a Thursday morning. I would later go on to name this game North Korean Summer Camp. Here's how it went down. Hey kids, I said, how about when the bus comes, we play a trick on the bus driver, and you all pretend you are in the worst summer camp ever, and I'm a super mean teacher. We'll line up single file, and none of you will say a word the whole time we're on the bus. You'll just look sad, and I'll look really mean. I was a little worried they'd see right through my plan, a game that involves sitting still and being quiet. Yeah, right. But these kids were 100% on board. A game that involves pranking an adult? Oh yeah, let's do this. We were all excited to try out this game, and finally the shuttle bus showed up. The kids silently boarded the bus in a line behind me, took their seats, and sat totally still for about 2 minutes. Then one of the kids saw a building he recognized and fell out of character.
Hey, I've been in that building,
he said. This is when the game showed its real muscle. The other kids shushed him. It was incredible. They had taken this game on as their own. After a while, the other passengers on the bus got off, so it was just my group and the driver. I decided to take it up a notch. When one of the kids made a little sound, I turned around and yelled,
If you kids don't be quiet, we'll have to do the same thing today that we did yesterday.
They got quiet. I turned around and faced forward. We arrived at our destination and got off the bus.
Thanks,
I said to the bus driver.
Have a nice day,
he said back. Colleen, who was helping me with the class, felt so bad about our prank that she felt compelled to tell the bus driver we were messing with him as she got off the bus. Once we were clear of the bus, the kids and I erupted in laughter and self-congratulations. They had pulled it off even better than I had expected. But now that we had created this brilliant act, we couldn't just call it good. We had to parade this show around campus. Let's prank everybody, not just that poor, unsuspecting bus driver. So on our way back across campus, I took the kids through the library. One of the girls' fathers works in the library, and as I led the line of silent, stoic children through the building, I could hear him calling out to his daughter,
"Josie! Hey, Josie! Josie!"
with no reply. Now that was just creepy, like I was in some sort of Brain Snatchers movie. The younger kids had done so well that I was pretty excited to pitch this game to the 4th through 7th graders in the afternoon class. They were definitely on board, but also took it up a notch. First, they wanted everyone to line up from shortest to tallest, which really added to the creepiness. Second, they thought I should yell at kids individually. All right. Third, whenever I asked them a question, they were to reply with either,
"Yes, Supreme Leader,"
or,
"No, Supreme Leader."
That was my idea, actually. With these new ideas, we headed out on the same little field trip the morning kids had been on. I instructed the kids to walk about 8 feet behind me, and I never turned around to acknowledge their presence. In fact, when I went through a door, I wouldn't even hold it for them, so the poor first kid in line would have the door closed right in his face. I can't imagine what this must have looked like to people. Once again, we got on the shuttle bus, but this time there were more people. These older kids did a better job of staying in character, so nobody talked. At one point, a cheerful middle-aged woman on the bus tried to make a little conversation with our group.
"Is this a kids' camp?"
she asked.
"It's a storytelling camp,"
replied Colleen.
"Oh, are you kids having fun?"
she asked. No reply. None. Crickets. Oh man, it was amazing. There were too many of us to fit into the smaller shuttle bus that would take us back to our classroom, so I decided we would walk back. After all, this would give us more opportunities to freak people out. As we were heading back, one of the kids started mustering real tears. It was incredible. She's a born actress. The kids who couldn't generate real tears just put a little spit on their fingers and dabbed it on the corners of their eyes. Along the way, we passed a group of tourists waiting for the bus. I waited until we were a good 100 feet past them, and then turned around and yelled,
"Who's laughing? Did I say you could laugh?"
"No, Supreme Leader."
"Do you know what the laughter of children sounds like to me, huh? It sounds like nails on a chalkboard. Do you get me?"
"Yes, Supreme Leader."
We did a few more scenes like that along the way until the kids started getting mad that I wasn't yelling at enough of them. I know kids at that age are obsessed with fairness, but this was a new one for me. As we got closer to the classroom, I started to get that little nagging feeling that maybe this wasn't the smartest game to play. We might be slightly traumatizing people with our prank. But when a kid accidentally stumbled into a trash can and made a loud noise, I just couldn't help myself, and I turned around and yelled,
"Did I say you could hit that trash can?"
"No, Supreme Leader."
"Did you hit it because you're dumb?"
Now I was taking it up another notch.
"Yes, Supreme Leader."
We walked a little further, and I caught the glance of a woman through a doorway, and did she shoot me daggers? Wow. And that was the end of North Korean summer camp. At least until I tried it on my friend's kids when we went camping together the following week. It worked on them too. Despite the trauma of enduring probably the worst kids' camp in UAF history, the kids did come up with some very entertaining true stories. Here's one we recorded during camp as told by a born storyteller. Here's what happened. Andy was in the Seattle airport with her mom on their way back to Alaska. Here's Andy.
"We were riding on the escalator, and it was really crowded, so I sat down, which did not help the crowding at all."
"Mommy," I said, "will you please sit down with me?"
"No, honey."
"Please?"
"No." "No."
"Fine. I said, as we approached the bottom of the escalator, I could see the flat part. What's sort of fun to ride on? And so, as we got closer, I got more and more excited. But then, for some weird reason, before I even sat down on the flat part, my mom started screaming, "Get up! Get up!" "Mommy, why are you saying that?" I asked, but it was too late for me to be asking. I was already sitting on the flat part. For a minute, it was fun. But then, ouch! The escalator sucked my button pants into the cracks at the bottom of the escalator. It hurt. I jumped up and held my butt screaming, "Ow, ow, 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 Mommy!" My mom gave me a weird look that I don't understand either.
She gave you the look, right?
Yes. And then she took me to the bathroom to get my butt bandaged. It hurt for me to sit down, and so she gave me Motrin for the plane ride. But even though she gave me Motrin, it took about a half an hour for it to sink in. So I had to sit on the plane for a half an hour with my butt hurting.
Oh, and it was like a 3-hour plane ride, right?
Yeah. When we got home, my dad and sister started laughing hysterically as soon as they saw my butt and pants, which were all torn up. My butt had a lot of different lines that looked sort of like a barcode, so they called me the barcode butt for the rest of my life. Ugh!
Thank you very much, Andy.
That's Andy telling her story at the first and possibly last Dark Winter Nights Kids Storytelling Camp. Nice work, Andy. Our next storyteller was chosen at random from a group of folks who put their name in a hat at our live storytelling event back in January. Please welcome Roy Churchwell with this incredible impromptu story from his childhood.
So this is a story of how I first came to Alaska. Well, at least the first time. So, but it doesn't start out in Alaska. So I was born in Arizona. My parents had split up at this point, and one of the reasons that they had split up was because of my mother's addiction to drugs and her drug habit. At this point in my life, I was, I guess you would say, a bit of a criminal because I was helping my mom support her drug habit by breaking into houses. So at 4 years old, one of my jobs for her was to get boosted through a window in a house and then walk around and unlock the back door so that they could get in the house and steal stuff and then take it to pawn shops and make money that way to support her drug habit. My dad really wanted to get me out of this situation, but the courts wouldn't necessarily let him. He couldn't prove that this stuff was going on at that point. So he found out that she was going to drop us off at my grandmother's house, which was his mother's house. Him and his girlfriend picked me and my brother up at the house, and in a bit of their own law-breaking, kidnapped us and decided we're going to go to Alaska. So that's what we did. We hopped in the truck. We had an Airstream trailer and took off through Canada. And it was an amazing trip. It was 1979, so I was about 4 years old. It was so amazing. I still remember quite a few things from that. So we did a lot of camping. We stopped, I remember stopping at a place that was owned by the First Nations. And I remember a young kid who had this awesome raven that he kept on his shoulder, and the raven could talk. And I still want a raven that sits on my shoulder. I remember walking up to a dock in a lake one day, and looking down and seeing what I thought at the time was a huge alligator in the water, and went running back to tell my dad to find out that it was a pike that was sitting under the dock waiting for stuff to eat. So I'm pretty sure that fish was as big as I was, and as a four-year-old, that's not that hard, but it was pretty awesome. We worked our way up through Canada, got to the Alaska-Canada border, and it was a little hairy for my parents, or my dad and his girlfriend, going through the border. There was a good chance he thought that the Border Patrol might ask him some questions about him and his kids coming through the border. But I guess he must have looked Alaskan enough because they let him through. We kept driving till we got to the first town, which was Tok. And we set up in a BLM campground outside of town. In that day and age, you could basically camp for as long as you wanted in one place, and we did that. We were going to try and stay the winter. My dad was hoping to get a full-time job and make a life in Alaska at that point. We didn't really have a place to live, and my mom really wanted a cabin. And I guess in those days, if you couldn't really get a cabin, what you built was a wannigan, which my mom says was slang for if you want a cabin but you can't afford one, you build a wannigan. So we built a wannigan in the BLM campground. It's basically, if you don't know, a three-walled log structure that you put against, in this case, the Airstream trailer that we had. And we lived in there for most of the fall. We ate a lot of squirrels and grouse and snowshoe hares, so my parents were pretty poor at that time. I remember a few things from that period. We had some friends in town, and I remember they had a large king salmon that they had smoked whole, and it was in their cache, and that fish also was about the size of me, and I thought that was pretty impressive. At that age, I don't know, you remember certain things, so we didn't get spanked very often, but when you do get spanked, it's pretty memorable. So, and you were allowed to get spanked in those days. And so just a couple events. I remember my stepmom always made these English muffins with raisins in them, and I decided that they kind of looked like boogers. I was commenting on this for an extended period, and my dad decided that that was enough. But as kids sometimes do, I decided to take it the final last step that I shouldn't have and said, boogers. So I got a spanking for that. The other spanking I remember, I actually didn't get, my little brother got. We had made a trip out to Eagle. For some reason, my little brother decided to take off in the morning. We were camping and my parents were in the tent, and my brother and I were sleeping in the back of the truck, and my brother was just gone in the morning. So my dad tracked him down to the Yukon River, and he was pretty sure that he had drowned in the river. But he looked around town, and he looked down Main Street of Eagle, and he saw our yellow lab Buster at the bar, standing outside the door. And so my dad walked down there and looked in the bar, and my brother's on a bar stool eating French fries that some guy had given him. So my little brother got a few spankings on the way home that day. We were having an amazing time in Alaska. My dad decided that instead of hunting and breaking the law, that he should probably try and be an upstanding citizen and get a hunting license, which I guess maybe might not have been that common in 1979, but he decided to do that. But I don't know if they do it now, but in 1979, when you got a hunting license, I guess they ran your name to see if you had any prior convictions or anything. So they found out that he had kidnapped us and that he was wanted in Arizona. Interestingly, they could have just locked him up right there and flown him down to Arizona, but they didn't, because that would have left my stepmom and two kids in an illegal wannigan in the outskirts of a BLM campground outside of Tok. So they said that he could take us down as long as we left right away. So our friends with the king salmon, we gave them the wannigan so that they could cut it up for firewood, which they did. I think they used the plywood and the stove to make a sauna. And we headed down to, back down to Arizona. When we got back down to Arizona, we stayed with our mom, my real mom, for a little while, but she decided that having two kids around was a little more difficult than she really wanted to put up with. So after what in my mind, at this time anyway, seems like a couple weeks to a month, we were back living with my dad, which was a good thing. And so it was an amazing summer, and one that I still remember greatly, and fondly, actually. And it was one of the reasons that I decided to come back up here to go to grad school. So we came the next summer to Alaska again, but that's a different story, and so I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
That was Dark Winter Night storyteller Roy Churchwell. Our final storyteller today shared her story on stage at our live event during the Midnight Sun Festival in downtown Fairbanks this summer. This is Lori Schuning.
There you go. Hi, so thank you. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I grew up in Delta Junction for the most part, but for 3 winters, my parents actually moved to Fairbanks so they could go back to school. And so the story I'm going to share with you is actually something that happened here in Fairbanks. So I was about 7 years old. This is about 30 years ago. And my parents had made friends with this couple, Mark and Dana. And they lived out in the Goldstream Valley in kind of a typical Alaskan cabin. Lots of stuff in the yard, a dog yard. Mark was a musher. Dana, his wife, lived there as well with their 2 little girls. Mark had this young dog team, and he found out that I had never gotten to go on a dog sled ride, so he wanted to remedy that. So he talked to my parents and arranged for me to go on a dog sled ride with him. He picked me up from school one day and brought me out to his place to take me on this dog sled ride. And he had put a bunch of like plastic bags and sleeping bags in the basket of the dog sled to keep me warm. And he put me in the basket of the dog sled, and he had all the dogs hooked up. And then he was putting his gloves on, kind of standing behind the runners, putting his gloves on to get ready to go. This is the middle of winter, of course, so it's kind of cold, not super cold, but below zero. In his yard, like I say, typical Alaskan yard, was a stack of bowls, probably dog dishes or something. And he bumped this stack of bowls with his foot, and it spooked the dogs. They were a very young team and easily spooked. So they took off running, and he didn't have a hold of the sled. So off we went, taking off into the Goldstream Valley, which I'm sure you guys, many of you know, is just this network of trails. There are miles and miles and miles of dog sled trails throughout the Goldstream Valley, and probably even more so about 30 years ago. So we take off running. I'm scared because I've never been in a dog sled before in my life, and it feels like they're going very, very fast when you're sitting down in that basket. So they're racing along. Mark is running after me as fast as he can. There's nobody else home, so Mark's the only one that knows I'm in this runaway dog sled. And so he's chasing after me. Things start to fall out of the sled. He's falling farther behind. I realize, well, I guess once I can't see him, I should start throwing things out of the sled. So I do. I'm 7 years old, and I'm chucking stuff out of the sled, hoping against hope that he'll be able to follow this, you know, Hansel and Gretel trail of breadcrumbs to find me in this dog sled. Pretty soon, I can't see him anymore. We've gone around too many corners. And the dogs are not slowing down. It feels like they're not even slowing down when they're taking corners. Early on, he had been yelling for me to jump out, but of course we're racing so fast from my perspective that I didn't feel safe enough to jump out. So I didn't jump out. So I stayed in the basket and the dogs kept running. I was screaming at them to stop, but of course that's not the right command to make a dog team stop. So they didn't stop. They kept running. Goes on for hours. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to me, Mark has continued chasing me. So he's continued to run the trails. He's eventually come across a house. He's alerted the people in the house to please, you know, watch for this little girl and put out a call for someone to find this little girl in the runaway dog sled. The people do that. He continues running after me, hoping that the dogs will take some of the trails that they normally practiced on. Fortunately, at some point, Mark came out onto Goldstream Road and he flagged down a trucker. Okay, so there's this man in a truck, just a pickup truck, and he said, hey, you know, there's a runaway dog sled. If you see this little girl in a runaway dog sled, please stop the dogs. So sure enough, as luck would have it, a couple hours after we had left Mark's house, the dogs did turn onto Goldstream Road. So they were running along Goldstream Road, and this man in this tan pickup truck drives by me as we're running along. And I remember seeing him drive by and thinking, oh, maybe he's gonna save me, but he just kept going. Well, it turns out he was pulling forward so that he could stop ahead of me. So he stops ahead of me and he gets out of his truck and he runs down the embankment, and I'm just, my heart lifts, right? Because I know I'm finally saved. And he grabs the dogs and he stops them and he ties them to a tree. And he took me out of the sled and he put me in his truck and he drove me up to the Goldstream General Store. And the lady there was expecting me. By this time, word had got out around the Goldstream Valley that there was a missing child in a dog sled. I'm pretty cold. It's been hours in this cold weather with no sleeping bags or plastic bags left in the sled because I've been throwing them out as I go, hoping someone will find me if they can follow them. And so all I have is my winter gear on. So the man in the pickup truck carries me into the Goldstream store and he sets me on top of the counter, and the lady behind the counter with her best intentions says, oh honey, she said, would you like an ice cream cone? I said, no, I do not want an ice cream cone, I'm so cold. So she gave me these cookies, and you know, meanwhile, the man who had found me went back along the trails to find Mark, who was still looking for me. He found Mark and brought him to the store. Mark picked me up. Well, at that point, there was no way to get home except via dog sled. So Mark talked me up and he said, okay, you can do this. We can do this again. So we went back to the dog sled where and they untangled the dogs who by this time were all wound up. And this time Mark, got the basket ready because he had been picking up this stuff as he was running along, as much of it as he could. He got it ready. And he went over this whole spiel about how to stop the dogs, how to turn the dogs if anything like this should ever happen again. And then after he was standing with both feet on the rungs and both hands on the back of the sled, I got into the basket. He mushed me back to his house and took me home. So I made it, but it's quite the adventure. I haven't been a big sledder since.
So. Lori Schooning. Thanks for listening to this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. Today's episode was produced and edited by myself, Rob Prince. Matt Hutter of Alaska Universal Productions did the audio for Lori Schooning's piece. Dark Winter Nights is sponsored by our friends at Geek City Electronics. These are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Rob Prince.